My quest to try to understand dietary behavior in its complexity actually started off when I was in graduate school. And we know that habit is habit, as Mark Twain once quoted, that you cannot throw habit out the window, but you have to coax it down the stairs one step at a time. It is Mark Twain who also said that quitting smoking is very easy. I've only done it 1,000 times. So in terms of the quest to understand dietary behaviors, the predictors, the social psychological predictors, in the Chinese American population, but I hope that this will spark interest for research in other population groups, not just Chinese Americans. So I'd like to share my research. I was granted a sabbatical leave from January to June of this year to conduct research in Los Angeles County. And that is to also compare with the data that I already have in the New York metropolitan area. So I'd like to share with you today some of the highlights, and I hope that the take-home message will not only be the research study itself, but for our own personal applications and how that could really influence the behaviors that we engage in could really impact the health outcomes of our selves. I'd like to just provide some general definition overview. Looking at the definition of overweight versus obesity, with overweight, it's not just the excess amount of body weight, but that could come from water, it could come from muscle and other bone and fat as well. But when it comes to obesity, it is an excess amount of body fat. And the reasons for that is an energy imbalance. So when it comes to intake of dietary intake versus the output of energy expenditure, we see that there is an energy imbalance. And oftentimes, it's measured in terms of BMI. I think many of you probably have heard of BMI, body mass index, which is weight over height squared. So that's something that I like to address. But when we look at in terms of the weight-related health issues, it has been linked to type 2 diabetes. It has also been linked to high blood pressure and a host of other cardiovascular disease. You know, if we were to count 1 to 17, every 17 seconds, someone in the United States is diagnosed with diabetes, which is high blood sugar levels. And so that is dramatic because approximately over 50 million people may be pre-diabetic, but they don't know that they're pre-diabetic. And so it's important to realize that obesity is a growing health concern. It is fueled by personal choices. And for the past, when you think about the past 30 years itself, it is a worldwide epidemic, especially that we see changes in countries that have become more and more westernized, especially in Asian countries, with economic prosperity, with high-fat, high-energy diets, all fueling that. You know, this year, in April of 2017, the world population hit its new high. Does anyone know how many people are in this world today?
8.5 billion?
Close, not as high. But actually 7.5 billion people. I remember in 1999, it was October 1999, that the 6 billionth person came to being in this world. And so now, how many years later, now we're at 7.5 billion altogether. And so approximately 30% of the world's population are either overweight and or obese. That's over 2.1 billion people. And so we see that in 2008, United States and China, because of the sheer numbers of people, they had the largest numbers of overweight and obese are in the U.S. and also in China. And so there's shifts when it comes to economic prosperity. The past 30 years, the obesity epidemic in the U.S. has grown. It's propelled by personal lifestyle choices. It's deeply rooted in the social environmental conditions. We think about, you know, why is it 1990, 2000, 2010? We see here that a lot of states, especially in the southern area, you see greater than or equal to over 30% of adults that are actually, in obese category, we see their changes here. Is it lifestyle? Has our genes changed over the years, over the decades? You know, what is growing here? Is it technology? You know, all these factors, have a play when it comes to the changes in demographically. When we look at obesity among minority groups, we see Asians here in yellow. It's a total, in terms of looking at age-adjusted prevalence for adults over age 20, is about 11% for Asians, still much lower than other ethnic groups, such as whites, about 33%, blacks are about 48%, and Hispanics about 43%. So we see that, yes, Asians overall is lower, but at the same time, we need to be careful because there's a difference, in different ethnic groups because, we cannot lump Asian Americans all together. Asian Americans may be about 12% obese, but if you compare it to the Native Hawaiians and the Pacific Islanders, about 44%. So there's a marked difference in the numbers here. And when we refer to Asian American, it's actually countries in the Far East, in Southeast Asia, the Indian subcontinent is included. It is so broad as a whole that when clustered together to be labeled as Asian would be misleading. So many times, health professionals may think that Asian Americans are the model minority group, but be careful because as a whole, when clustered together, combined, it appears that there's no health issue related to obesity, but that is not true. We know that Asian Americans are not a homogeneous group. Chinese Americans are the largest subgroup among the Asian Americans in the U.S. Currently, about 6% of the U.S. populations are Asian Americans. It's projected to double in about 40 years. So it's one of the fastest growing population groups, Asian Americans, in the U.S. But it's interesting because there's a different standard for Asian populations. When we look at a normal BMI range is somewhere between 18.5 to 24.9. And you could do the calculations. You take the weight, divide by height squared. And so in a BMI of just in a normal range of 19 to 20, we see that Asians tend to be more of an apple shape. Okay, in terms of there's more of a genetic tendency to accumulate body fat in the belly area. So that is called visceral fat. Sometimes they refer that to skinny fat. And because of this type of apple shape versus pear shape, is there a difference when it comes to metabolic outcomes between the two shapes? Is there a difference when you looking at apple versus pear shaped. Let's look at some of the common benchmarks here. This is for the general population group when we look at overweight is greater than or equal to 25 and obese would be greater than or equal to 30. That is for the general population group. The World Health Organization in 2004 realized that Asians across the world are different in terms of they tend to develop more diabetes at the same BMI as a white or European person. Because of that, the findings that there seems to be a difference there, they put together an Asian benchmark that is lower at 23 cutoff for overweight and 27.5. And in order to measure abdominal obesity, BMI has its limitations because we know of football players with high BMI levels, but because of muscle mass, there is a limitation when it comes to using BMI alone. But something that when we look at abdominal obesity, this is one of the measurements that they refer to is waist circumference. And for the general population males, does anyone know what the cutoff is for males? Is 40 inches for the general male population. But because, this is 40 inches right here, because Asians have a different standard, it's actually 35 inches for Asian men. Okay, for Asian men. And then for females, 35 inches for the general population. But because of this, in terms of the visceral fat tends to be more in Asians, it's 32 inches as a cutoff. Okay, so this is what is using in terms of looking at the visceral fat. And what they do is they take the hip bone and they measure it right level with the belly button. So that's how they measure, in terms of using waist circumference. So we see that there is a different standard for Asian populations. Metabolically, diabetes and cardiovascular disease are seen at a lower BMI levels in Asian Americans. And then compare that to white Americans of the same BMI. Asian Americans tend to have about 3 to 5% more body fat, and also 30 to 50% more likely to develop diabetes compared to non-Hispanic whites at the same BMI levels. But it's also important to realize that one could have a normal BMI but be metabolically unhealthy. And you may wonder, how could that be? About one quarter of the U.S. population, about 25%, according to research by Unger and Scheer, stated that about one quarter of the U.S. population have a normal BMI but are metabolically unhealthy, meaning that there's muscle loss. Okay, as we age progressively through the decades, we lose muscle mass. Okay, so sarcopenia is the name for it. There's an excess tendency for visceral fat around the belly area. And so that's what we're referring to. Reduced fitness, insulin resistance. Insulin is a hormone made in the pancreas. It's like a shuttle bus that will shuttle glucose into the cells of the body to be used for energy. And what happens is that it becomes resistant. Okay. Diabetes as a result of that, high blood sugar levels. Inflammation is going on throughout the body, chronic inflammation, high cardiovascular risk, and also cancer risk is related too. But however, conversely, on the flip side, one could be overweight yet be metabolically healthy at the same time, meaning that they're fit, they're not losing muscle mass, they're also have no diabetes, no, in terms of any type of indicators of metabolic disease is not there at all. So again, we have to look at it carefully. It's not just one-sided, but conversely, one could have, to be overweight but yet be metabolically fit. When you look at studies looking at U.S.-born versus foreign-born Asian Americans, there is a difference seen. U.S.-born Asian Americans tend to be more overweight and obese compared to their counterparts that are foreign-born. And we see a lot of the acculturation of dietary habits. As immigrants come to the U.S., they're eating more animal processed foods, a lot more dairy. So in terms of adapting the dietary habits of the host country. And so they've seen that country of origin or place of birth, rather than the years of U.S. residence, might be a better predictor of being overweight, according to OCAR and others. And also, there's a positive relationship. The more years of living in the U.S., the research has shown that there is an increase in terms of the weight gain over time. So there's a positive relationship between the two. I'm actually a second-generation Chinese-American. My parents, both of them were born in Taiwan. I was born in Canada, so I call myself a Canadian-American Chinese, but I'm a U.S. citizen here. But I grew up in New York City for many years in terms of was influenced by the Chinese culture as well as the host American culture and the influences there. I like to share the purpose of my research study is to look at the attitudes, beliefs, behaviors related to obesity prevention among Chinese Americans living in LA County, which is the number one in terms of the most Asian Americans throughout the United States. Of all the counties, Los Angeles County has the most. And do you want to take a guess? What's number two? New York, yes. So here are the top two residing in both areas. And we think about California being the home of the earliest in terms of the Asian immigrants, especially from China. So in my participants for my survey were 18 to 60 years of age, had a sample size of over 203 in LA County and New York metropolitan area, 447. So these were both U.S.-born and foreign-born individuals, healthy, free living. It was a convenience sample. Just curious, how many here have been to L.A. County? A show of hands, have been to L.A. County? Only a few. And so here's L.A. County. I had to scout the land. I'm not from L.A. And so I had an interactive map looking at of all the different areas and where were most of the Chinese Americans residing in. So it turns out that I was able to drive to Torrance to a Chinese school in that area to be able to find participants, went to Monterey Park where there's a lot of Chinese community, Chinatown there, Pasadena. I stayed there for a number of weeks, Pasadena up further north, Arcadia, and also San Gabriel, which I remember driving through miles and miles of, there was just so many Chinese restaurants and grocery stores. It was incredible, and especially in the San Gabriel area with a lot of especially more recent immigrants there. It was interesting. I flew out multiple times to L.A., and every time I flew and I was sitting in my seat on the plane, my neighbor and the people surrounding me would be watching La La Land, the movie. And how many here have seen the movie La La Land? Okay. Do you remember the first scene of La La Land? What happens in the first scene? The traffic jam right on highway. I'm not sure if it's which highway it was, but every time I flew out there, okay, this is what I need to become prepared for. So I rented multiple cars and drove all around LA County to be able to be able to solicit participants and go there. UCLA, I was able to get the Asian American Student Organization to post my online. I have a survey that was also online in hard copies, so they were nice enough to put that on their website to try to get students to participate. I stayed mostly at Fuller Seminary at the guest house there, and there were numerous of students from different Chinese backgrounds as well. I was able to walk around campus. I met the director of family studies, and he shared my study with all the psychology majors in the master's degree there, so that was very helpful. I will never forget 168 Market. I don't know if they have that in the East Coast, but this is a popular West Coast supermarket. And this is San Gabriel. And I remember going in, and I spoke to the manager in my broken Chinese, saying who I was and could I distribute the survey. And he says, yes, you could do so outside of in front of the supermarket, but you can't, give it out inside. So I ended up going there 4 or 5 days, standing out there for 2 hours at least. I was able to have my elevator speech for 20 seconds to introduce myself and to see if they would be interested in participating in my study. I'll never forget this one woman who drove by and she took my survey. And then about 10 minutes later, she came by again and she said, well, could I have 10 more surveys? I could give it out to all my friends here. And then it didn't end just there. Another 10 minutes later, she had her college age daughter come with her and said, please give us another 10, 20. We'll give it out for you. And so this is a great to be able to have some type of, outreach. Pasadena City College, approximately 30% of its student population are Asian Americans. And so I was able to meet an English instructor, and she helped to give out the survey itself. And so especially around the area of Pasadena area. There was a couple of Chinese churches in the area that was open for me to be able to have participants fill out the survey. And also a couple of Chinese schools, especially in the San Marino, Torrance area, and parents were willing to take it home and fill it out and mail it back. The New York metropolitan area was the other side in terms of looking at the east side, where data was collected in the five boroughs as well as New Jersey area. I had a validated survey instrument. I collaborated with Dr. Kathleen Bauer to put together questions related to dietary beliefs, attitudes, behaviors. And this was approved by the Institutional Review Board. I used the guiding theoretical frameworks of the health belief model and theory of planned behavior. This is the sample survey that I had. There were 140 questions altogether, and that was the challenge with seven pages. I'll pass this around, but I had surveys, hard copies to give them with self-addressed stamped envelopes. And so measuring behaviors, measuring attitudes, a lot of the social psychological factors and demographic questions were at the end. So I'll just pass this around, and this was the survey instrument that was used for the study. It took approximately 20 minutes to complete the survey. Validity was achieved through a pilot sample that I had prior to this, giving it out to actual participants to ask for the clarity of the questions, looking at in terms of whether it was comprehensive, did it also achieve the constructs or the concepts that I was measuring. So the validity and reliability was also tested for the survey. It's so important to have incentives. Although there was a raffle drawing at the end, in terms of the period of time, it was gift cards for the raffle drawing, but I realized that to have something tangible made a big difference. And my friends out there suggested, let's have self-winding flashlights. It turned out to be a big hit. It was kind of interesting. We had all these adult participants who were wanting different colored flashlights and pouches, too, in terms of as an incentive for filling out the survey. I'd like to share with you what the theoretical framework that I used. Kurt Lewin, the father of social psychology in 1935, said there is nothing so useful as a good theory. When you think about theory, it seems so complex, but theory in a nutshell is very simple. It is simply an explanation of why things happen, and that's what theory is. You and I have these everyday theories in terms of how this world operates, our daily life. We have these theories. Theories are not etched in stone. They, can be changed as more research comes. We're using these everyday theories. So I'd like to show you the theories that I used for as a guide for the survey project. This health belief model was actually introduced in the 1970s by Rosenstock and Kirsch, and they were looking at specifically the issue at hand in the 1950s was tuberculosis. And so this became a reason for understanding why Americans were adapting, looking at screening techniques and why there was a widespread failure to make use of that. It is to have a prerequisite is to have one to be perceiving themselves at risk to a disease or condition. So that's called perceived susceptibility. Perceived severity is simply, if I were to contract an illness X, I believe it will either financially or somehow affect me negatively, whether career-wise, etc. So that's perceived threats altogether. And whenever you make a decision, how many here actually put together a list of pros and cons? Some of you might just put a list of, and then if pros outweigh the cons, what will most likely happen? You'll probably do it, right? If pros outweigh the cons. What if the cons or the barriers outweigh the benefits? Probably not. This is the whole essence. Here it is. Likelihood of behavior change is the perceived benefits minus perceived barriers. And so there are other things that could prompt action when it comes to health behavior action. You hear on the radio, you see something on your tablet, you know, in terms of some type of notice, with prompt action. I think now it's flu season, and so we hear a lot about getting your flu shots and so forth. But also it could be a personal symptom felt by the person that could also prompt action. So this is called the health belief model, and I use the concepts and measure that in my survey. The other theory that I used was the theory of planned behavior. According to Eisen in 1980s, and he postulated that intention is the best predictor of behavior. When you got up this morning, what was your intention? Just curious. When you got up this morning, what was your immediate intention?
Be as productive as possible.
Be as productive. And then were you able to meet that goal?
Somewhat.
Okay. And what got in the way, if I may ask?
I ran out of time, or I got called.
Okay, sure. Right, so we see that although intentions, you know, according to the research, is the best predictor of behavior, there are so many things that could come into its way. I think besides looking at intention, there should be also some type of, you know, in terms of looking at planning. When will the behavior take place? Where would it take place? How? And how should it be done? And also coping plans. Just in case, you know, something happens, what will you do to cope with that? So in order to predict intention, attitudes are bipolar. Attitudes are either you know, when you're on Facebook, what are people trying to garner here on Facebook? People want to post something. They're all looking for what?
Likes.
Yes, they're looking for likes. You know, attitudes are bipolar. Either you like something or dislike something. It could be favorable, unfavorable, pleasant, unpleasant. And so attitudes is also could be measured by behavioral beliefs. Think about your favorite health behavior that you love doing. What is it that you love doing? Your favorite health behavior. Could I have a volunteer? Yes.
Swimming.
Okay. So, Pat, when you swim, what do you believe is going to happen?
I feel I'm getting exercise for the day. I feel good. I feel I'm going to sleep well.
Okay, great.
And
so
I just enjoy it.
Good for you. So you believe that by swimming or doing X, Y is going to happen, meaning that it will make you feel good, it'll help you to sleep at night.
It also makes me hungry, which isn't good.
Okay, yes. And how much do you value feeling good? Is it extremely important to you or not at all?
Yes.
And how about sleeping at night?
Yes.
Very, very important. So this is called value expectancy. We believe by doing X, Y will occur. Okay, which is why outcome will occur. And how much do you value that outcome? So this is the basis for the theory of planned behavior. Subjective norms are peer pressure, okay, which also could influence one's intention. It's the important others in your life. Let's name them. Whether doctors, I don't know if doctors are important to your life, you know, your spouse, your friends, okay, your parents, your children, your professors, maybe, okay, are, you know, whether they approve or not approve of you engaging in the behavior. And will you be motivated to comply with their wishes? If my doctor were to tell me to cut down on my soda consumption, would you do it? Okay, so that's looking at, you know, motivation to comply. And also behaviors, some behaviors are under our control and others may not be under our volitional control. When we say volitional, that you have a will to control that behavior. Okay, so those are factors that influence intentions. And so that's the theory that I use. Perceived behavioral control is likened to self-efficacy. Self-efficacy is different from self-confidence. It's not the same thing. What is self-efficacy? It is the confidence to do what? Yes, to perform a behavior. Okay, self-efficacy is the confidence to perform a behavior, and that has been shown to be highly, very strong, strongly correlated with actual behavior. So I also measured self-efficacy in terms of their confidence to perform specific behaviors. I'd like to just show you some of the examples of the questionnaire items that I used. It was based on a 5-point Likert scale, strongly agree, strongly disagree. And then what's in the middle? If it's 1 to 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, what's a 3 denoting?
Neutral.
Neutral. Okay, yes. So I did have a neutral category there. So I didn't force participants to either agree or disagree, but they could, you know, provide a middle ground. Perceived benefits. As long as I eat lots of fruits and vegetables, my chances of becoming obese will be very low. Barriers. I find it hard to prepare home-cooked meals due to lack of time. Susceptibility. I may develop obesity because of my sedentary lifestyle. Perceived severity. If I become obese, my career will be jeopardized. And a lot of the phrasing was due to our interviews that Dr. Bauer and I, we interviewed 40 Chinese Americans and were able to analyze the results and use those statements to generate questionnaire items. Cues to action, health segments on television or radio are a reminder that I should watch my weight. And self-efficacy, how confident are you in consuming small portion sizes of food? From statements from the theory of planned behavior, looking at intention, I measured their intention in the upcoming week. I plan to choose smaller portion sizes. Their attitudes, choosing steamed foods over fried foods, is it favorable or unfavorable? So here you see the bipolar nature of attitudes. Normative beliefs, in general, how much influence does your friend have on your food choices? Motivation to comply. If my friends were to give me advice on dietary matters, I will follow or will not follow it. You know, you think about your own personal dietary choices. Are you influenced by other people? You know, how much of that influence is there? Looking at some.
You with that, when I think with my friends, I try to adapt with them or follow what they, for example, provide of choice, even though I doesn't like it in my lifestyle, but to make a good relationship, I agree with them about their choices.
Okay, so you'll agree with them to make, you know, to be able to, at certain settings. In terms of perceived behavioral control, I am in control of my weight. Some of the behaviors that I measured were simply on this index card that you have on the sheet. Do we have it all passed out in terms of people in the back? There's some extras here. This is what I measured, 19 behaviors in particular. And it was based on 4 points. It's rarely, never, sometimes, often, or usually, always. So some of the categories that looking at for yourself, you think about the psychological aspect of it. In the past month, did you take time to relax, to reduce the amount of stress you felt, to improve your emotional well-being? How often did you do that in the past month? Maybe you think about that. What about, were you able to exercise at least 30 minutes, 3 to 5 times per week, walking? If you parking your car, walking to the train station, it'd be vacuuming the house, okay? So that's considered also some type of physical activity. And also, when you have your leisure activity, it's kind of interesting. Nowadays, all the leisure activities, most of it seems to be internet-based or tablet-based or in terms of games, video games, and so forth, too. When you think about in every 60 seconds, is it possible that 10 minutes out of the 60 minutes, would you be able to move around? Is it possible every 10 minutes out of 60 minutes, is it possible for you to move around? You know, if you're working in front of your desk computer, are you able to walk around and try to kind of aim for that? The eating context, home-cooked meals, using smaller portion sizes, more traditional Chinese food patterns, like, you know, when it comes to looking at more, you know, vegetables, less red meat, using portion size control methods to help decide what to eat. Do you measure your in cups, in serving sizes, in terms of how much, you know, one consumes? Looking at the food context, what about in looking at using steamed foods instead of fried foods, limiting oils or fats when cooking, fruits and vegetables consumed and whole grains, Healthful snacks. So these are some of the part of it. It's interesting in terms of high-calorie beverages. You know, I have to admit, I do love Starbucks. I'm wired to drive to Starbucks, you know, almost every day because I love their coconut macchiato, you know, and so forth, too. And so this is something that, you know, we are driven to, you know, because we want that reward or we want that, you know, that feel-good and so forth, too. But you realize, you know, alcohol consumption, looking at different types of beverages, it is loaded, especially with sugars, you know, and so forth, too. In terms of knowledge, awareness, context, in monitoring your body weight, or did they learn more about obesity prevention through reading articles or some type of YouTube in terms of speakers and so forth, too? So these were the 19 behaviors that I measured, which were my dependent variable. Looking at the percent of response rate, I approached about 500 people in LA County in person, of which about 350 took my survey home, and 203 mailed it back to me, thankfully. I was hoping for a higher sample size, but it is a 58% response rate. The New York was a 65% response rate. It was collected in 2002, and also the first stage was in 2008. So there were a lot more subjects that were collected as a total 650 altogether. I like to look at some of the demographic findings and compare the two, looking at the differences. Approximately 68% of the LA sample were females, 68% right here. The mean age was 38 years, range 18 to 60. You see the dividing up, there's mostly about 41% were between the ages of 41 to 60. So this was the highest category that I had here. Looking at BMI for the general population standards, so about 62%, you know, indicated this was self-reported data looking at height and weight that calculated to be of normal body weight. And when you put these two together, it was about, you know, 23% or so, give or take, overweight and obese. Interesting enough, if we were to use the Asian cutoffs, you know, proposed by the World Health Organization, these two categories would be approximately 38%. So there's a difference in terms of using the general standards and also the World Health Organization standards. Looking at the New York sample, it was very similar in terms of the mean age was about 36. Also, most of the females largely comprised the sample of the New York. I had a lot more younger age subjects in the 18 to 29-year-old range, about 46%. But looking at the BMI distribution, was very similar to the LA sample. The interesting part is the income reported more than $80,000 and above was higher, about 30% of the LA sample indicated an income of greater than $80,000 a year for the annual income. Interesting, when I compared the behaviors, 19 behaviors, there were 8 that were significantly different between the two East and West Coast. And these 8 behaviors were statistically significantly different looking at the average. Do you want to take a guess? Is it LA or is it New York that came up in terms of to have a healthier profile?
New York.
And what's the reason, the rationale for New York?
The automobile.
Being able to not drive as much?
You can't get anywhere in LA without getting your steel box.
That's true. You're right. They're driving everywhere in LA. So you feel that the New York sample pretty much had more indicated higher. Do you agree? Does someone else think it was LA? Okay. So it's kind of interesting. All 8 behaviors were statistically significantly higher in the LA sample, in LA. It was actually, when you look at, they indicated eating more steamed foods instead of fried foods, limiting more in terms of frequently their portion sizes of the foods, the LA mean compared to the New York, New Jersey mean. So it was statistically significant at P is less than 0.05. Other behaviors significant was eating more healthful snacks. In LA, they indicated consuming more. This is out of 1 to 4. Okay, the mean is the highest for 4. The lowest would be never at 1. Limiting intake of high-calorie beverages, also higher in the LA sample. Eating at least 2 servings of fruits and vegetables, at least 3, 1-ounce servings of whole grains, also indicated higher in the LA sample. They also indicated that they exercise a lot more, okay, and also engaging in at least 1 physically active leisure activity was also statistically significant between the two. So it was kind of interesting to be able to compare looking at the factors and looking at the differences in the mean values. I also performed regression analyses to look at what social psychological predictors best predict the behavior. Okay, so these were statistical tests that I used to look at 11 psychosocial predictors that what we just talked about, attitude and subjective norm, intention, from the health belief model and theory of planned behavior. This is what came out to be significant. Of all the 11 social psychological predictors, self-efficacy came out to be most dominant in my regression analyses. And self-efficacy, once again, is the confidence to engage and perform a behavior. When you look at self-efficacy, looking at the origins and Bandura in 1986 proposed self-efficacy as a really important factor. You know, self-efficacy comes through, especially through small incremental steps and gaining confidence, gaining mastery over a behavior. It's also self-persuasive statements saying that I can, yes, I can do it. Yes, I can perform this. I can do it. So that will increase self-efficacy in people when it comes to adapting behaviors. Attitudes also came out to be highly significant. So one's attitude, you know whether you like to do something or not. You know if you enjoy riding your bike. You know if you enjoy swimming. And so that has a big factor in terms of whether you will actually engage in the behavior. Your attitudes toward the behavior matter a lot. And one has to believe that by doing X behavior, Y outcome will occur, like what Pat had mentioned, being able to sleep at night to feel better. And how much do you value that outcome? So those are very important. Intentions, not just saying that, yes, this morning I intend to work out, but truly coming out what, where, when, and how. What kind of behavior this morning? And some coping plans, just in case it rains later on today. What are my coping plans? So we see these prediction of close to 39% for the LA, and this is out of 100%, and 47%. A lot of the literature reviews, when looking at prediction of behavior, is usually about 30% or less. So this was slightly higher than reported in the literature, but at the same time, there are still variables missing. We're still not really understanding the best predictors of behavior because it's only 30%. Still a 39%, it's not 100%. Well, in the future, what other variables should we look at to be able to increase the prediction of behavior? So it is confirming for both counties the importance of self-efficacy, intention, and attitude when it comes to engaging in prevention behaviors. I'd like to just really briefly I also looked at t-tests comparing the means between some demographic characteristics of LA versus New York. These were all statistically significant. LA, slightly higher in age, statistically significant, P less than 0.05. The education level was higher in the LA sample. Work hours, 36 hours on average as opposed to 26 in the New York sample. Income, as a result, also was higher in the LA sample. So that's something that one would have to keep in mind, that looking at demographically, there was differences in the two samples. These were not statistically significant. Both actually had similar BMI levels of 22, about close to 23. Stress levels, activity levels, and even exercise hours was very similar, too. They were not different in terms of the mean values between the two counties. I like to wrap up and just highlight the major conclusions of my study, the influence and importance looking at self-efficacy, attitude, and intentions when looking at interventions. I also looked at normal weight LA participants, found out self-efficacy and attitude contributed a lot to the behavior. Those who are in the category of overweight and obese, that intention was the sole contributor of that. It's kind of interesting. With Asians, we know that eating oftentimes is a social event, you know, for a lot of cultures, not just for Asians. I wonder in terms of subjective norm or social pressures did not come out to be salient or significant. Some researchers say that it's hard to measure, you know, social influence in a questionnaire, in a pen-paper questionnaire. Or another factor is that eating is subconscious. We don't really know the social impact that others have on our eating behavior. You know, we like what we eat, and we will go ahead and you know, choose the foods we eat, but it could be subconscious. So that could be a limitation, definitely, in terms of why subjective norms did not come out to be significant. However, in my New York sample, subjective norms did come out to be important, significant in the younger age group. And so the younger versus the older participants. In summary, LA adopted higher frequency of prevention behaviors, and these were the eight that we just mentioned earlier. They also had stronger favorable attitudes and intentions to engage in the behaviors. What about the New York sample? Okay, what were they particularly high in? You know, when I looked at the New York sample, they perceived greater barriers, interesting enough, to adopting health behaviors because they indicated lack of time, through the survey responses, inconvenience, and the cost factor of healthy foods in the New York area. They also perceived that there was such strong, I don't know if you all live in the New York City area or in the outskirts, the metropolitan urban, there's a strong physical environment here. The external cues like the media, okay, we're bombarded with food advertisements all the time. And so especially people who work here, you know, with so much fast food restaurants, the prevalence of that has an impact. So there was statistically significant differences in perceived barriers between the two samples. There are limitations to the study. First of all, I was not able to randomly select individuals to participate. It was a convenience sample. Convenience sample of volunteers versus non-volunteers. There are differences. You know, research shows that volunteers tend to be more health conscious than non-volunteers when it comes to survey participation. So that could be definitely, the generalizability is limited. We cannot generalize to the entire Chinese American population here in the U.S. Because of self-report, okay, there's this social desirability bias. You and I know how to please health professionals, right? We know what the right answer is, right? We know what to check off, you know, when you're, you know, doing a health or survey. We know what the right answers are. There's the social desirability bias. And yes, over-reporting may have occurred in healthy behaviors and the under-reporting of weight, especially among females. And that could be the reason why that the BMI levels were higher in males than the females. Okay, so that's something that we have to look at carefully. And because of the cross-sectional nature of it's collected at one point in time, there was not multiple points in time longitudinal, which is advantageous. So that has its limitations because we cannot prove cause and effect. Okay, we could just look at relationships. Positive relationships. If X goes up, what happens to Y if there's a positive relationship? It goes up. If X goes down and it's a positive relationship, what will happen to Y? It will also go down. Okay, if it's a negative correlation or relationship, if X goes up, what happens to Y? It'll go down. They move in opposite directions there. So we can only look at correlations and not causal, you know, cause and an effect. I do want to say that, to my knowledge, for the strengths of the study, this is, to date, an innovative West and East Coast study of participants in the Chinese American community in two large urban areas using the same exact survey instrument. And the targeting of various cultural, educational, academic, religious, social, economic backgrounds in a multi-state regions is what, that we sought out for. Because of the shortage of Chinese American obesity research, it points to the need for future research to use longitudinal surveys over time to look at stability of perceptions, stability of attitudes, behaviors. So again, at one point in time, people could change, you know, 1 year later or 6 months later. A larger randomized sample to increase generalizability of the results. Perhaps even sampling in other Asian countries to look at acculturation factors. It's kind of interesting. Taiwan. This is my first time in over 30 years that I went back to Taiwan this year, where my parents' hometown. And what I found is that Taiwan, one of the highest obesity rates because of Taiwan, a small island adjacent to mainland China. And so it's kind of has surpassed other Asian countries when it comes to the westernization, the food. It was just awesome. I couldn't believe what they were serving at restaurants. And yet this is a crisis, you know, that has reached a point there as well in terms of an epidemic. And so looking at other Asian countries to ascertain the psychosocial predictors would be important. Comparing these behaviors to Caucasian population groups, I hope to do that in the near future. And this study, to be able to add and provide nutrition researchers, educators, to glean insights into effective counseling, the design of educational interventions, to look at new policies that could be enacted to mitigate obesity rates, especially in two different environmental aspects. When it comes to, it's great that New York City now has bike lanes, designated bike lanes, right, to promote exercise. But two different environmental aspects need to be looked at more carefully. I hope that this research will serve as a springboard for future research that could be used in other ethnic population groups. I'd like to provide acknowledgments to my colleague, Dr. Kathleen Bauer, who collaborated with me with the interviews and validating the survey instruments and helping me with the New York collection of the participants. Dr. Yun Bei, my statistician of the New York sample of participants. Emily Fowler, my graduate assistant at Montclair State University in helping me to locate organizations in LA. I'd like to thank my cousin, Roger and Jin, and for their assistance, especially in the area of LA and the recommendations. Ellen Wu Tang, resident in LA County, was my right-hand person there, my college class, you know, NYU friend. And she was just my cheerleader, texting me every few days, like, how many surveys have you gotten back yet? So I'd like to thank especially people there. And so in terms of any questions, I'd like to open the floor up and thank you for your participation and to coming out and hearing me speak.